Here's the
Wednesday, September 25th, 1985. Ministry of the Bulletin, written by Jenny Elliott. Is that right? Didn't you write it? Didn't you write the whole thing? Well, we are going to talk about the sin offering. This is where conviction comes heavily upon the class. Soft chair. Makes the conviction easier. Although we should move to the other room. We'll keep it here. So, let's see what we can come up with on this. This is starting in chapter 4. The sin offering overall signifies the forgiveness of sin through the offering of Christ. It might be good to open one of those doors back there. A little warm. Signifies forgiveness of sin through the offering of Christ. It's not real easy to tell exactly what's involved in the sin offering, and then there's what appears to be a sin trespass offering, and then a trespass offering. But overall, this offering was to atone for unintentional sins, as well as sins of ignorance, also what we could describe as unwitting sins. So unintentional sins, sins of ignorance, unwitting sins, as well as for rash acts. And these were sins that were revealed as sin in cases where no restitution was possible. You couldn't make restitution. So you have unintentional sins, sins of ignorance, unwitting sins, also rash acts. And they're sins where no restitution could be made.
Rash acts meaning just spontaneous.
Yeah, we're all pretty familiar with them.
You got it, Mike. I'll talk extensively at you this evening. No. Oh, isn't this fun? This fun. Okay. A point I want to make before I go any further with this is if we compare the first three chapters of Leviticus, which are the burnt offering, the meal offering, and the peace offering, with 1 John chapter 2, verse 1, there's an interesting parallel. Notice how 1 John 2, 1 says, just listen to this, "My little children, these things write I unto you, that ye sin not." Notice, he's writing things so that they won't sin. If we would live out, and I think this is where God is taking us by His Spirit, where we'll be able to live out by His strength the burnt offering, the meal offering, and the peace offering, would we be committing any sin? So if we could live out those three offerings, we would not need the sin offering. We wouldn't need the trespass offering because we'd be walking in the Spirit. We'd be walking totally surrendered to God. And so there's a parallel. He wrote the first three chapters of Leviticus saying, "I write these things that ye sin not." I'm giving you truth. I'm giving you revelation so that you can see that there is a place. There is a place. It's out there somewhere where we don't have to sin. We don't have to disobey. We don't have to stumble. We don't have to sin in ignorance. We don't have to sin unwittingly. Now, we're a long ways from this place. But there is that place of walking in experiential righteousness. Now, I don't know what that will really be like. I don't know what degree we'll actually walk in such a place. But it is available. Christ is the pattern son. And we are to be like unto that pattern. So there's an interesting parallel here. But see, he knows that we're still going to sin. And notice the very next statement, and if any man sin. And it's not really, you know, now, if any of you perchance would happen to sin, I know it's rather remote and highly unlikely. Well, just to comfort your hearts, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. No, he's not saying it that way. He knows we're going to sin. And he is saying it to comfort our hearts. But he wants us to know that these things are given and that they can be appropriated and we don't have to sin. The idea that we have to sin is not true. Now, we are going to sin. We are. It's just the way that it is. And sometimes if we would accept that more honestly and openly, we wouldn't be as susceptible to frustration, discouragement, condemnation. We end up along the way here having some false expectations as to how we should be doing, which really makes us vulnerable to the attacks of the enemy. He wants us to know there is this place where we can walk without sin. And we don't have to be drawn into the dark world that is all around us. We can be drawn to Him with His cords of love. That's what He wants. But He knows we are prone to error. He knows we do have a lower nature. He knows how sin has impacted us. And so what provision does He make? A sin offering and a trespass offering. See, God is not He's not fooled by anything. He knows where we're at. He knows what we're going to do. And He's made provision. But He wants us to know that He hasn't made this provision because, well, there's no way to live without sin. No, there is a way to live without sin. But He knows we're not going to easily find that. And He knows that we're not going to just automatically live there or easily live there. So there's just this interesting parallel between the first three chapters and the second two, the next set of chapters, which actually goes into chapter 7, and then this verse in 1 John. Now here in Leviticus chapter 4, verses 2 to 12, this speaks of atonement, that is, forgiveness, for unintentional sins of the high priest. Now it is quite amazing that he starts with the high priest. Here he is talking about the sin offering, and who does he start with? The number one person, so to speak, as far as spiritually, as far as the one who is in charge of the tabernacle, who is, in a sense, everything revolves around this person. It would be like starting with atonement for the unintentional sins of the pastor. See, starting right at the top. And it's an important thing that we understand that the people at the top need forgiveness just as much as the people at the bottom. And it's not that they're committing the same type of sins, the same number of sins, but they are going to be committing sin. And they need forgiveness just like anybody else. Nobody is exempt. Nobody is in a place where, because they occupy this office, they don't commit sin. They all commit sin. Every single person commits sin. And there are some people that we might look at and kind of feel like, well, I can't even imagine what kind of a sin they might commit. But all commit sin. All stumble. There's unintentional sins committed by every single person. We don't know the number, and we don't care to know the number. But we have to look at one another the right way. We have to see one another from the right perspective. You know, we inadvertently put an awful large degree of pressure on ministers, elders, teachers, pastors. We oftentimes expect way too much from them. And they end up having demons sent their way, and they have to live up to this pressure. And so instead of them being able to just be themselves and live with freedom before God, they have to live under more or less requirements of the people that aren't requirements of God. That's an unfortunate thing. And I think the Lord is going to help us to see where this happens and how it happens and how we add fuel to this fire And then he's going to show us how we can get out the fire extinguisher and take some of the logs off the fire as well, so that we can be more of a support. People in the ministry, for the most part, I don't think if they really give thought to this, I don't think they feel very understood by the people. I don't think that they feel very accepted. I don't think they feel. I know they feel very lonely for the most part, because who is it they can confide in? Where do they find friendships? Things like people like Jimmy Swaggart. I can't imagine that he has a friend in the world except his wife. And I'd be surprised even if his wife was a real close friend, you know, just considering how the devil works to block things in marriages. You know, I don't know what the case is really, but people like that generally are extremely lonely and greatly misunderstood. And there's pressure put upon them by people around them where they're expecting so much of them. So if they ever make a mistake, people just attack them. They don't give them any space to make a mistake. So I think it's very significant that we start with the high priest. That's the very first person he talks about regarding sin. I think that is a very, very significant thing. He says here in verse 2, if a soul shall sin through ignorance against any of the commandments of the Lord concerning the things which ought not to be done, and shall do against any of them, if the priest that is anointed do sin according to the sin of the people, then let him bring for his sin, which he has sinned, a young bullock without blemish unto the Lord for a sin offering. Now this word for sin is chata, C-H-A-T-A, C-H-A-T-A. It means to miss. It's essentially in meaning the same as the Greek word hamartia, which means to miss the mark. It's the same idea, to miss. C-H-A-T-A. When it says sin of ignorance or sin through ignorance there in verse 2, it shows the error, that is, the missing, to be an inadvertent thing. It's inadvertent. It wasn't premeditated. It was unwitting. It was unintentional. You can note with that Psalm 19 and verse 12. He's not talking about sins of omission. He is talking about sins of commission, that is, actions, acts, where things have been done wrongly. But the kind of acts that he's talking about are acts committed by a person at a time when he did not suppose that what he was doing was sin. He didn't really know it was sin. Now, he may have been under a deception. He may have been confused. He may not have stopped to really weigh it carefully. David didn't really understand that he was committing sin in all the events there with Bathsheba. I think if he would have stopped, he would have really known what he was doing. But in that, it was more, in my opinion, a sin of ignorance. He did not really realize there was a deception that came upon him. And this may not be the case. Maybe it's not a right assessment. I don't really know. But when Nathan was telling him the story about the man who had one lamb, he didn't catch on to the meaning at all. And you'd think, well, he would have, but he didn't. And when he said, "Thou art the man," that was quite a shocking thing. Now he knew it. It was a sin of commission. But he didn't really mean to sin. It wasn't his heart to sin. It was something that he did inadvertently. Now he had no excuse for it. God was going to have to deal with him and judge him for it and chastise him for it. But it wasn't a premeditated thing where he said, "I know this is sin. I know this is wrong." At least as far as what we can tell. Now maybe he did to a degree actually know. But maybe because of the pull and rationale, deception, maybe he really didn't know. It's difficult to say for sure. Now, these sins, they are done deliberately. But at the time, the person did not perceive the sin involved in the act. So it's a deliberate thing. There is a decision. But the person didn't realize that it was sin. And maybe way in the back of their mind that they did. But see, we're not talking about where somebody is purposely going against God. They know this is wrong. They know it's against God. And they're doing it on that basis. We're talking about the way we generally sin. We're not generally fighting God, setting ourselves against God. Now, what we do wrong, we've done it deliberately. We made a decision. We made a choice. But we really didn't perceive it as sin at that point. And it's not that we want to commit sin. That's not the purpose of things that we're doing. We want to do what's right. I feel like in our church, we really want to do what is right. There's a large nucleus of people who really want to do what is right. But we're not always doing what is right. We're much like Romans chapter 7. What we want to do, we don't find the way to do it. And what we know we shouldn't do, we end up doing it. And it's not what our heart is. But we find that there's forces, things in us working against us. And we do end up committing some wrong acts along the way. Quite a number, as a matter of fact. Another thing that works to cause this is a lack of truth and a lack of tender conscience. So at times we don't have tender, we don't have a conscience that is tender enough, and so it hides the fact that this is sin. We're just not aware that it's sin. Our conscience has been seared. We've had a lot of wrong concepts built into our minds. We don't see everything accurately. This is why we need to be compassionate with one another. And really considerate of one another. Especially when you consider what our heart is. Our heart is to live for God. We wouldn't be here if our heart wasn't to live for God. So we don't need to speak to one another as though our hearts aren't to live for God. I think that's being very unfair with our brethren. We find in the scriptures that Christ had compassion on the ignorant. And we need to have compassion on the ignorant as well. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 2. It is really a sin of ignorance. And these things aren't easy to explain. And in some cases where you'd think, well, now he couldn't be ignorant of what he has just done. He is ignorant. He does not know what he's done. In other cases where you can think he's ignorant, he knows exactly what he did. It's not always easy to tell. We don't know how to read it ourselves. We're not sure sometimes what has worked against us to get us to do what we have done wrong. They're not easy things to assess. When you start trying to get down to what a person's heart is and what's causing them to do these different things and what the motives are and what their thinking is, we need to be really careful of how we assess that with one another. We want to be fair with one another, tender and thoughtful and considerate. Now, when he mentions the anointed priest there in verse 3, New American Standard reads for that verse, if the anointed priest who sins so as to bring guilt on the people, see, he sins so as to bring guilt on the people, then let him offer to Yahweh a bull of the herd without defect as a sin offering for the sin he has sinned. Now, when we compare verse 3 with verse 23 and then with verse 28, what we find is this. The priest's sin offering is a bullock, and it's greater than the sin offering of the ruler of the people. The ruler of the people offers a he-goat. And then what the ruler of the people offers is greater than what the commoner offers. The commoner offers a she-goat. So bullock, he-goat, she-goat. Priest, ruler of the people, commoner. Why the difference? The difference is because the sin of each, see, of the high priest and of other priests, that will affect the people more than the sin of the ruler of the people. This man's sin will impact the people more than this man's. And this man's sin will impact the people more than this man's sin. And so that's what he's showing here. Showing the greater impact because the person's in a higher office. More responsibility. More people looking to him. This is why we're not to be in this striving for all sorts of positions in the church. There's great accountability. Phenomenal accountability. We're too concerned at times about ministry, being in these certain positions and having people look at us and think certain things because we occupy this prominent place. We need to say, forget it. Whatever the Lord wants, that's what I want. And if you really understand what's involved in some of these things, you don't really want those higher positions. You don't want them. I mentioned that in a class. I told this one class, I said, I don't want to be a pastor. I don't want the responsibility. I mean, I was just talking very candidly. He wrote me a note and thought I needed deliverance. I thought he needed deliverance. I'm telling him that he really needs to think soberly about wanting to be in certain positions in the church, and it's not a light matter. Because I recognize it's not a light matter, I would just as soon never occupy the position. I don't think I need deliverance. I think I've got revelation. That's how I feel about it. I feel like I realize that it's very serious. I'm not saying that I'm going to balk at God's call. But I want to, if it's God's call, then I need to have His strength. And I'm not going to pursue it in my own strength. I don't want it in my own strength. It'll end up destroying me. I don't want to be destroyed. I want to get to heaven. You know, I don't care to occupy a position here and end up missing the rapture and during the great tribulation, somehow losing my soul. I don't care to have that happen. Now, the anointed priest here is the high priest. The high priest was the only one spoken of in this manner. He's anointed. That's in chapter 8, verse 12. The others are described as being sprinkled with oil. Chapter 8, verse 30. And there's more to it than that, and we'll talk about it when we get to chapter 8. But this term, anointed priest, is talking about the high priest. Now, when he says he's to offer a sin offering, there at the end of verse 3, says, for a sin offering, this term, sin offering, is one word in the Hebrew. And it's chatath. So it's very similar to the word for sin. It's C-H-A-T-T-A-T-H. C-H-A-T-T-A-T-H. Chatath. And the word means an offense. Sometimes it can talk about habitual sinfulness. But the basic idea is just an offense. Committed an offense. But it doesn't just stop with the idea of an offense. It also means the penalty. An offense plus its penalty. God is trying to stress a point. He doesn't want people to just have the idea, well, it's an offense. He wants us to also have tied right in with that the fact that there's a penalty with the offense. Sin carries a penalty. It's just not a wrong action, and it's no big deal. It's a wrong action, plus there's a penalty. And in order to have it taken care of, there has to be an atonement. There has to be an offering made. Now, this offering for sin made by the high priest was the same as if the entire congregation had sinned. And that's what's mentioned in verse 13. It says, if the whole congregation has sinned, then they have to make this same offering. So here's the high priest. He sins. He has to offer a bullock. If the whole congregation has been found guilty of a congregational sin, they have to offer the same thing. So the high priest offers this. The whole congregation, if they've sinned, they have to offer the exact same thing. And there's a connection there. It shows when Jesus Christ who was our anointed priest, when he took our sin upon himself, see, he took our sin. He took the sin of the whole congregation. He had to offer exactly what would be required of us if God exacted the sin penalty from us. See, here's the whole congregation. They've sinned. Now, God requires something of them. What did Jesus Christ do? He came and He took our place. So what the congregation would have had to offer, He came and He offered that exact thing in our behalf. See, if God would have had to exact the sin penalty from us, He would have said, this is what you have to pay. Now, that wouldn't have done us any good, because that wouldn't have cleansed away our sin. A sinner offering himself, a sinner shedding his own blood, doesn't do him any good whatsoever. So that's why God did not exact the penalty from us. He exacted it from Jesus Christ. He exacted the same thing that He would have exacted from us, but it wouldn't have done us any good. So that's why it's the same thing. It shows that He, our high priest, our anointed priest, bore our penalty in full. This is the penalty for the whole congregation. He took it. He took that entire penalty for us. Now, another thing about Him talking about the high priest here is that He's emphasizing the human frailty of even the high priest. He's emphasizing the human frailty of even the ministers of the gospel. There is human frailty. There is human weakness. We all have it. We've got loads of it. No matter how somebody might look, he's got weakness upon weakness upon weakness in numerous areas of his life. So he starts right here with the high priest and he says, I want you to know this man has frailty. I want you to know this man has weakness. It's a big thing to God. It's a really big thing. Hebrews chapter 7, verses 26 to 28. The church as a whole, and I mean born again, spirit-filled saints, they do not understand who their pastors are, who their elders are. They don't understand what the ministry amounts to. In my opinion, almost they hardly know anything about it. The view that people have of ministers is so erroneous. It's horrible. They don't understand who that man is that's standing up in that pulpit, and they put him on top of a some sort of a pedestal. Thank you. And they give him a wrong honor. They view him in a wrong way. And God isn't degrading the person. He's just showing what the truth of the matter really is. And God wants us to understand what the truth of the matter really is. In verse 6 he says, the priest shall dip his finger in the blood. So they are draining the blood from this animal. And they'll sprinkle of the blood seven times before the Lord, before the veil of the sanctuary. That is, before the veil of the tabernacle. The veil represents Christ's flesh. So he dips his finger in the blood and he sprinkles it seven times directly in front of the veil. He walks into the holy place. He's in the holy place and the veil separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies. And he sprinkles his blood there. Hebrews 10, verses 19 and 20. Hebrews 10, 19 and 20. The veil represents Christ's flesh. See, there's a connection between the veil and the blood. Christ's flesh, Christ's humanity. The number seven is divine perfection. Seven times. Or you could say divine completion. The blood shed by Christ's flesh on Calvary. See, blood shed, the veil representing Christ's flesh. It's blood that was shed by Christ on Calvary is in fulfillment of a perfect divine plan. That's the number seven. And it's that which opens for us the way to God's throne. It opens the way to the ark, and that was considered God's throne because it was God's dwelling place, the ark and the mercy seat. And it shows that Christ's blood is the key to our being perfect, even as our Heavenly Father is perfect. The number seven, shed blood, acceptance by God. He wants us to be perfect, even as He is perfect. The shed blood of Christ is the key to that whole matter. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 48. It also shows that the blood is our path to the very presence of God. It's the path to the Shekinah glory. Because on the other side of the veil is where they found the glory of God. See, there's one other connection you can make. It's going to be in His presence that we're perfected. It's going to be as we're really there, partaking in His glory and communing with Him. That's where we're going to find perfection. That's where we're going to find transformation. We're not going to find it by just trying to live by our own strength as well as with God's strength by the principles. It's not what's going to do it. The principles are absolutely vital, but they're not going to make us perfect. We need to find the way into the Holy of Holies. We've got to find our way into the very glory of God. And otherwise, we're going to just remain the imperfect people that we are at present. And we'll have some changes, of course, but the changes that we need, they'll never be wrought. They'll never be wrought in our lives. But the non-spirit filled, he's not going to make the bride. He can't get there. He doesn't even have the realm open to him regarding God's power. He's got to get filled with the Holy Spirit just to even have that realm available to him. But just to have it available isn't enough either. You've got to find the way to actually move in it, partake of it, appropriate it. We've got loads of imperfections. We've got to find the way to be made perfect. We've got to find the way to be made into His image and His likeness. We've got to find that way. Now, what they also did, and it's shown in verse 7, won't read the verse, but they took some of the blood and they placed it upon the four horns of the golden incense altar. What you have here is that in this building, in the tabernacle building, this is the Holy of Holies, and this is the holy place. This is the veil right here. Right directly in front of the veil is where you had the golden incense altar. And then there's also a table of showbread and the golden lampstand. And then out here is the laver and the altar. And in here is where you find the ark and the mercy seat. So the horns, they're just looking at it from the side. They were horns that probably just came out by itself. That was going to look like rabbit or something. What do you think? We're going to erase this real quick. I won't have your attention if I keep that on the board. They put blood on the horns of that altar. They didn't draw any faces on there either. So, and there were four horns, and it was made of wood overlaid with gold. And so that's why it says four horns of the golden incense altar. There's wood involved, but it's overlaid with gold. So the blood is actually placed upon the gold of the altar. This incense altar, incense represents prayer. The horns represent power. The number four speaks of universal. So you've got blood. You've got four, which is universal. You have horns, which are power. And you have incense, which is prayer. So a good possibility as to what he's saying is, we find power in our appeal, that is, in our prayer to God for forgiveness. See, we're talking about forgiveness, sin offering, in Christ's atoning blood. See, this person is offering a sacrifice to have their sins forgiven. They're making an appeal to God. We want this appeal to have power. Well, the only way this appeal is going to have power is in Christ's atoning blood. He's not going to power any other way. The number four shows that it's available universally. And it's an appeal that man can make universally to God. In other words, all of mankind is able to pray and is able to find Christ's blood available to remove the stain of sin. Everybody can. It's available to every single person. So that's the idea of the number four, universal. It's universally available. All can find access to God. All can find forgiveness. They can. It is available. That's why it's four horns here. And that's why each is covered with blood. Now, he also mentions in verse 7 that the remaining blood was poured out at the base of the sacrificial altar. So what's involved here is that when they killed the animal and drained the blood, they took a portion of that blood and they went into the holy place. And he dipped his finger and he sprinkled it 7 times. And then he took another portion of that blood and he put it upon the four horns of this incense altar. Then he leaves the holy place and he goes out to the sacrificial altar in the court and he pours out the blood there near the sacrificial altar, this altar of sacrifice. And this shows how the blood removes the judgment that is due because of our sin. That altar out there speaks of judgment. That altar is not a real pleasant thing to look at. You're seeing animals being burned up all the time. And there's one facet of it that is wonderful, where through Christ we can find acceptance before God, we can give ourselves to God. But if we don't stay in Christ, if we don't keep giving ourselves to God, everything turns around, and that altar is a horrible thing to consider because it speaks of judgment coming upon us. It speaks of God's fire consuming us in judgment. So to take this blood back out there and pour it out at the altar shows God accepting the blood and removing the judgment. It further emphasizes His forgiveness. If He says, I forgive you, and you know the judgment is removed, you know you're really forgiven. And it doesn't mean that there isn't any chastening, because there are times where there is chastening. But as far as a final penalty of judgment, it's all removed. That's a very comforting thing to know. Especially with some of the sins we might find out that we've committed. It's quite an amazing thing to be going along in God and thinking you're doing well and then find out you've really messed something up. In a pretty significant way. It's kind of shocking to find out that when you thought you were doing well, you even made a fairly large mistake. Now, that's pretty sobering. What that has done for me, it's helped me to not have a real prideful opinion of myself. I don't say I have this in perfect balance, because I know I don't. And I'm sure that there's low self-esteem involved in some of this, but I know I'm going to make mistakes. And I'm not going to kid myself. And even after I've made what I feel are pretty deep commitments to God, I know sooner or later I'm still going to make a mistake out here. I'm still going to do something wrong, even when I thought I was doing everything right. I just know that it's going to be that way. And I'm not bringing that upon myself. I just know it's going to happen. It's happened before. Sooner or later, it's undoubtedly going to happen again. I know enough about myself, and I know enough about these demonic spirits. I know enough about my remaining carnality and how things can just happen in circumstances and pressures and all. I know I can stumble again. And so I'm not saying that, you know, I'm looking forward to that and I'm planning it and got it all put down on my calendar. But I just pretty much know it's going to happen again. And I just feel like, well, that's facing life a little bit more realistically. And now I've taken some pretty hard falls as far as being disappointed in myself. And I don't really want to add to that. I've been disappointed enough as it is. And if you start to think, well, now I've made this commitment and I'll never do this thing again. I think you really need to reconsider putting things in those terms. The word never, that's a pretty strong word. And to think you'll never do that again and you'll never get tripped up by something like that again. Well, I hope so, but I doubt it. And I don't think that's lack of faith either. I don't think it's lack of faith at all, and I don't think it's talking negative. I think it's just facing it the way that it's probably going to be. Never is a very strong word. Now, I want it to be never, and I hope it's never, and I hope it for my sake, and I hope it for your sake, but I still have my doubts. And I don't think those are demonic doubts either. Now, in verses 8 to 10, it's showing Christ as the sin sacrifice who yielded up to God all of his inner affections. Now, what these verses are saying, so you take the fat of the bullock that covers the inwards, the two kidneys, the fat that's upon them, and which is upon the flanks, the column of the liver, also with the liver, with the kidneys, and it's showing these innermost parts. So we're talking about inner parts. And it shows Christ as the sin sacrifice who yielded up to God all of his inner affections. See, these are inner parts. They're the inward parts. They're inner affections. He yielded his inner desires. He yielded his inner emotions. In other words, he surrendered himself to God. If I'm going to really ask God for forgiveness, I'm going to have to do some surrendering. It can't be a word game. I can't be holding back and saying, but please forgive me. It's not really going to work. We've all noticed that it doesn't work real well. If we're acknowledging a sin and we want forgiveness, right along with that, what is he requiring? More sacrifice, more surrender, more commitment. And we're going to have to do that or else the sin will just catch us again. It'll just catch us again. The reason we got caught is because we may have lacked a certain amount of commitment, lacked a certain amount of sacrifice, whatever the case might have been. So it's showing how Jesus lived his life, not my will, but thy will be done. And if we will keep doing that, then we'll find more and more that we don't have to offer this sin sacrifice. We won't need to. We'll be more and more in a place of living out experiential righteousness. Now verses 11 and 12 show that the rest of the bull, the rest that was remaining, was to be burned outside the camp. They take some of the blood, sprinkle it, put on the horns of the incense altar, pour some at the altar of sacrifice, burn up these certain parts on the altar of sacrifice, and then they take the rest of the bull to the outside of the camp. They take it all the way outside. That's what's shown in verses 11 and 12. In Hebrews chapter 13, verses 11 to 16, it shows how Christ became sin and he was forsaken by God. And just what we see in Mark 15:34, where he says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Mark 15, verse 34. Now, what happened in this? Jesus, as it were, was separated from the camp. He was separated from the presence of God. See, he was put outside. So you take the rest of the bull and you burn it outside the camp. It shows what was involved in Christ becoming sin. Now, it says that it was burned up in a clean place. And this was the same place that they put the ashes. Remember how we talked about before the ashes were taken to a clean place? Well, they took the rest of this bull to that same clean place and burned the bull up there where these ashes were. The clean place can be representative of heaven. And it shows how God accepted this offering in full. And the ashes, that's what testifies of God's full acceptance. See, fully consumed, fully accepted. God accepted this offering. God says, yes, I accept that. And you that trust in it, I'll forgive you. If you trust in that offering, I'll forgive you. But we have to trust in that offering. Now, notice also, he lists what they took out there to burn. The skin, all the flesh, the head, the legs, the inwards, and even the dung of the animal. Some of these things sound quite peculiar. Now, what does the skin represent? This represents all that which was seen outwardly of Christ. All of it was acceptable to God. The skin, that's what you see outwardly. It was all acceptable to God. That is, Christ's image, the outward, the image, what was reflected outwardly. It was all acceptable to God. The flesh speaks of the soul, speaks of the will. It speaks of more so what was inward and how that was acceptable to God. So you have the skin, then you have the flesh, and then he even mentions the inwards, the other inner parts. And that's listed near the end, but I want to mention it here. This even speaks further of the inner man that was in perfect conformity to God's will. I think this speaks of his likeness, that he was in the very likeness of God. I think it's a good possibility that the skin can represent the body, the flesh represents the soul, the inwards represent the spirit. All of it was accepted before God. This man lived body, soul, and spirit in total acceptance before God. And these parts being burned up show the full acceptance of God. God fully accepted it, totally accepted it. The head speaks of Christ's position of headship. That was pleasing to God. Christ, regarding his reasoning, his mind, his decisions, he submitted totally to God. God was putting him in a certain position. You know what Christ did with that position? He kept surrendering it back to God. You know what you do with gifts of the Spirit that God gives you? In the right way, you give them back to God. In other words, you let him run the show. You don't take the gift and you run the show. You let him run it. You keep the gift, but you put it in his hands. You don't decide to use this gift of healing when you want to use it. You let him anoint. You let him direct. Same thing with other gifts of the Spirit. Same thing with teaching ministries, apostolic ministries, prophetic ministries. You keep putting it back in God's hands. And I don't mean you push it off so you say you're unwilling to yield. Say, no, I'm willing to yield, but I'm going to do it at your discretion. I'm going to do it when you want me to. I'm going to do it in the fashion that you desire. There are people that are given ministries and gifts and callings, and they take that and they just run with it themselves. And they run right off a cliff. Yeah, splat. That's just about what happens to them, spiritually speaking. The legs represent Christ's ministry, his whole ministry, his entire walk was pleasing to God. See, everything about Christ was pleasing. Then it also mentions the dung of the animal. And I think this connects with Philippians chapter 3, verses 7 to 14. Where Paul said he counts all these things but dung. Because he wants Christ. He wants the will of God. I think that's exactly what Christ's attitude was. He didn't have a place to lay his head. He didn't have a wife, didn't have a family, didn't have a purse, didn't have a job, didn't have these things. He counted it all but done. He said, I've got one thing to do, and that's to be about my Father's business. And that's how he lived his life. It shows what Christ's heart was. He was just giving himself totally. The things of the world, they didn't matter to him. Now, he needed food, he needed rest, he needed clothing, he needed shelter over his head, he needed those basic things. But he always had it in right perspective. He never had anything out of place as far as this should be here, but he had the priorities all mixed up. He didn't have anything like that. He kept in tune with his Father, always in contact, Spirit always plugged in to his Father's Spirit. Now, verses 13 to 21 go through and talk about the atonement for unintentional sins of the entire congregation. And it's all very similar to this regarding the high priest. And the same offering is made. A bullock is required. So that's verses 13 to 21. Then verses 22 to 26. This is where atonement is made for the unintentional sins of a leader of the people. And what he would offer is a male goat, a he-goat. So bullock for the high priest, bullock for the entire congregation. This is where the entire congregation has somehow as a whole sinned before God. There's times that the church as a whole has sinned before God. So the high priest and the whole congregation would offer the same thing. Now this is a leader of the people, this next category. He's in a lesser position than the high priest. He's still ruling the people. He's still leading the people, but not in the same capacity. He does not have the same high office, same rank of spiritual importance as far as leading and guiding the people. His sacrifice is of a lesser cost. It's a male goat without defect. Can't have any blemish. Now, with this particular sin offering, not only is it a different animal, but there is no sprinkling of blood seven times in front of the veil. And there is no blood placed on the incense altar. So there's nobody that goes into the holy place and sprinkles blood. And there's nobody that goes in and puts blood on the horns of the incense altar. What he does is he puts blood on the horns of the sacrificial altar. So nobody goes in the holy place. He's out in the court area and he puts blood on those horns of the sacrificial altar. The sacrificial altar has horns just like the incense altar in the holy place. And this is wood overlaid with brass rather than wood overlaid with gold. This shows that the ruler's sin pointed more so to the camp. See, he's a ruler of the people. So his sin points more so to the people. Whereas the priest's sin pointed more to the holy things, to the things of God, involving God's presence, the tabernacle. So that's why he goes into the holy place, and the ruler of the people, he goes out here where it would be more public, more seen. This man is involved in a certain sense more so with the people. This man is more so involved with the things of God. We'll talk a little bit more about this after a break. You can get your bulletin up here.